Spock, delighted to welcome to the show a man who is nothing less than a photographic legend. He is Alan Tannenbaum. Good morning. Welcome to BBC Radio Scotland.
Good morning, Janice. Good to be with you.
Very good to have you. I am a huge fan of your photography. I mean, I'm a big fan of photography in general, but your work is astonishing. And before we come on to talk about the range, the array of the beautiful people, the not so beautiful people, the famous and the infamous that you've photographed over the years, just tell me, what first got you into photography?
Actually, it was an Englishman. I was living in San Francisco in the 60s, and everything was new and very exciting there. And before the whole hippie thing happened, actually, but I met a guy named Barry Miller, who I'm actually still in touch with, and he was into photography, and I just got interested and started teaching myself photography while I was living in San Francisco.
Wow. And isn't that interesting? Because how times have changed. What kind of camera did you have? I'm thinking now everything's tiny and digital.
It's changed a lot, but I got myself a 35mm single lens reflex, which is still the basic type of camera that I use. But as you say, yes, it's a digital camera now. It's not so much film anymore.
So you've embraced the digital age then. You're not snooty about it.
No, not at all. I want to keep working and shooting, and that's what you have to do.
And I suppose it helps you, actually, because you can instantly look at your photographs and reject or not.
Well, when you're shooting, yes, you can tell, you know, whether you have it right away or not. But when I was shooting film and chromes, you had to be really accurate. Mm. You know, you had to know what you were doing, and because you couldn't see it. So, you know, that's carried over into the digital age for me.
So San Francisco, a turning point for you. But you're originally from New Jersey, is that right?
I was born in New Jersey. It's a great place to leave.
Yeah.
And it encourages you to go to places like San Francisco and New York City.
Yeah.
But I grew up within sight of New York City. And as a kid, my parents would take me there. And I fell in love with New York even as a kid. And it was natural for me to end up there.
And that was the major turning point, particularly the Soho Weekly News was the paper that you worked for. But just prior to that, weren't you considering giving the whole thing up?
Well, I was. And I had given myself a deadline to get something as a photographer by the time I was 30. So just before my 29th birthday, I saw the Soho Weekly News, an 8-page giveaway paper on a bar in Soho.
Yeah.
And I picked it up, and I found out that they were looking for a photographer, and I went to see the publisher. And he looked through my portfolio, stopping at a photo of Jimi Hendrix that I had taken in San Francisco in 68, and said, you know, I used to be Jimi Hendrix's publicist. So I said, okay. And then he finished looking at the portfolio, and he said, yeah, you know how to take pictures. I'm giving you a job. We pay $5 an assignment.
Yeah.
If I like your work, I pay you $40 a week.
Yeah.
And he gave me an assignment, which was the Avant-Garde Festival, an art festival in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked out of that office saying, yes, this is it. This is it.
Now,
and
what year was that?
1973.
So it was $40 an assignment. Was that pretty good?
It was $5 an assignment.
Yeah. But and then $40 a week. You remember this so well.
I thought it was pretty good. And, you know, you didn't need a lot of money then. I was living in a shared house in Brooklyn with other people. The rent was $90 a month. And, you know, these things are unheard of today. But I also made a deal that he would pay for my materials, that I would be the photo editor of the paper, and that I owned all the copyrights to the material.
Now, wait a minute, this is too shrewd. I mean, this is extraordinary. You're a guy desperate for a job. You get offered one and instantly you're negotiating terms like that people would, to this day, envy. You retain copyright.
I don't know how I knew to do that, but I did. And, you know, I'm glad that I did.
Now, you said the first assignment, you go out, an avant-garde art festival, and I suppose that gives us an insight into what Soho was like in those days. I mean, it was extremely hip and happening, wasn't it?
Before it became a shopping mall for rich people?
Yes.
It was the art center. And I don't think, you know, it was even actually before it was hip and happening.
Mm-hmm.
It was where the artists were. There were spaces there. They were available. And that's where artists, and not only artists, but musicians and theater people and video people all were able to get large spaces there and do their work.
We're talking about these big lofts now that cost an arm and a leg.
Right. And when I got mine in the section, which is now Tribeca, didn't even have a name then, my loft was $350 a month. And so, you know, that's how it happened.
That's amazing. And you've stayed there ever since, haven't you?
I'm still there.
So tell me then about the kinds of people that you were photographing, because as well as those sort of avant-garde people, I suppose there's a kind of a crossover with the likes of Warhol. Then there's the whole Studio 54 phenomenon too. Were all of these sort of separated off, or was there a bit of a crossover?
No, there was a lot of cross-pollination between these scenes. The art world was very diverse. Pop art was still happening in the 70s from the 60s, so I got to photograph a lot of these artists like Robert Rauschenberg and of course, Andy Warhol. So, and Andy, you know, used to like to go out at night, so there was this whole nightlife scene. Besides Studio 54, there were places like later in the 70s, like the Mud Club, mm-hmm. which was a wonderful real artist's hangout in Lower Manhattan. They would have different themes every night. One night would be Soul Night, and then it would be a fashion show another night. Then they would have one of my favorites was the Rock Suicide Party.
What happened to that? Were there casualties?
No, but you know what it was different performance artists doing tableaus. So there was a set of, for example, Mama Cass choking on a sandwich,
and charming.
Janis Joplin lying on the floor with needles in her arms. You know,
yeah,
a windshield, a cracked windshield with a picture of Tommy Bolin. Nice.
It's the American dream. We love it. There's a very striking photograph of Andy Warhol looking extremely happy and animated roller skating. It's not the image of Andy Warhol that we're familiar with, or perhaps that he liked to perpetuate.
No, that was an unusual shot, and I'm really glad that I got it. And but Andy was out there. There's also the pictures of him with the late Divine, mm-hmm. where he's looking very animated as well. So Andy was having a good time. And when the Copacabana reopened in 1976, Andy was one of the sponsors of the party there.
Yeah.
So in addition to doing his visual art and his films, nightlife was a big part of Andy's life.
Another great photograph. I mean, so many. We could talk about one of Patti Smith. Is she on the roof of the Mud Club?
No, she's actually on the roof of my publisher,
right.
his loft building.
Right.
And she was very new at that time. Not too many people knew about her. And the publisher had this idea of her in the kiddie pool, and she was wearing a wet T-shirt and dropped her knickers.
Yeah, so she's sort of pretending the knickers are falling down, but it's a very engaging photograph. I suppose that's the thing about how you get into the confidence of these people. But maybe at an early stage in her career, the barriers were not up yet.
Well, that's right. I mean, it would be more difficult to do something like that when the star is more established.
I'm going to choose a record now, and I thought that this would be absolutely appropriate from the Deep Disco Culture, Volume 2, on my turntable all the time at the moment. So many great tracks, but it seems to sum up so much of what we're talking about at the moment. Crosstown Traffic and Party People.
Yeah.
Party People, Crosstown Traffic. What a great track and what a great guest I've got today. I could talk to him all day, but I've only got a few more minutes. So, Janice, cut to the chase. He's Alan Tannenbaum. So glad that you're with me today. You've photographed everyone. When it comes to music, what, the Stones, Springsteen, Bob Marley, Debbie Harry, on and on and on. And I suppose a striking sequence of photographs that you took of John Lennon and Yoko Ono, that was when they were still recording Double Fantasy, is that correct?
They had just released Double Fantasy.
Just released it.
And coming out after 5 years of seclusion with this album and starting to do a promotion for it. And they were speaking to five established media outlets in the States, like Newsweek and the New York Times. And I approached our music editor with the idea of doing something with them. And he agreed, and we approached them, and they agreed to speak to the Soho Weekly News. And that's how I got to photograph them.
Now, so many people listening to this right now will have seen those photographs, be very familiar with them in various publications. And I think that what is most striking about them is how happy this couple look together. Is that how they seem to you?
Absolutely. And we just came out with a new book called John and Yoko, A New York Love Story. And a lot of photographs that people are familiar with are in it. But also there are many, many photographs that have never been seen before.
Wow.
And I think that what comes across in these photos really, you know, justifies the title of the book. They were really very much in love, and it's very, very clear in the photos.
And John was particularly pleased with you, I think, because, you know, Yoko looked good in the photographs, which I think pleased him.
That's right. He said to me when I went to see them after the two photo sessions to review all the pictures, after seeing them, he said, "You know what I like about your photos? You really capture Yoko's beauty." And that still cuts my heart when I think of him saying that, you know, and how happy he was. And Yoko actually put that in the preface to the new book.
Yeah, because she.
That John, you know, you made John a happy man.
Because she's written the introduction to this book, John and Yoko, A New York Love Story. And I suppose, you know, you say it cuts your heart. This is the thing. This was shortly before his untimely death, his murder at the hands of Mark Chapman. That must have been extraordinary for you, given that you just had that close access. You're still photographing Yoko after his death. But how did you feel when you got the news?
Disbelief. I couldn't believe it. I was in the darkroom making prints to bring to them that evening at the Dakota. And I got the news from an editor at the paper, and I thought, well, maybe, you know, he's just wounded. He's going to make it. And I dropped what I was doing, grabbed my cameras, went up to the hospital, and that's when I found out that he had died. And I was just in total shock and disbelief.
I suppose in a way it's good that you got that access and you got those intimate, happy photographs because, you know, after his death, for example, there was the Albert Goldman biography, which painted a very different picture of the pair of them in his last years of him, you know, being a complete junkie, Yoko being absolutely controlling and so on. Did you read that book? What did you make of his assessment?
I didn't read that book. I think that there's a whole cottage industry of trashing John and Yoko, and I don't feel a need to be part of it. I had my experience with them, and whether I have illusions or not, I don't want to do anything to dispel them. My experience with John and Yoko is one that's been 100% positive all the time.
Now, you mentioned that you got hold of that apartment in Tribeca before it was even called Tribeca. You're still there, and of course, an apartment with a great view of the Twin Towers. You took some extraordinary photographs on that fateful day, 9/11. I think your wife, when she saw the first plane go in, she knew what was going on because you had taken photographs of the first attack on those buildings, hadn't you, years before?
We both knew exactly what happened. The irony was that after the Soho News folded, I spent almost 20 years going to hotspots around the world, yeah, chasing wars and other conflicts. And here I got the biggest and most dangerous story of my life, just six blocks from my home. But we both knew immediately that it was a terrorist attack. We heard that plane coming in. We could hear the engines. We saw the explosion. It was a beautiful, crystal clear day. There was no way that it could have been anything else but a terrorist attack. And, you know, we lived through that. And, of course, I ran out with my cameras. I was just a couple of blocks away when the second plane hit. I got caught in the debris storm when the first tower came down, and my wife saw that from our building. It was a day of horror.
You actually bumped into another photographer colleague, didn't you? And I think both of you had phoned home to your respective wives to say you were okay, but he did not come home.
There was a colleague of mine named Bill Biggert, and we had worked together in the Middle East and in New York, and unfortunately, sad to say, he was killed in the collapse. He was crushed by the building coming down.
You were down there, I mean, right in the middle of it. I mean, fortunately, the presence of mind to take cover, and you know, your life was saved because of that. But I guess it must be an odd thing, because as you say, you've been in war zones around the world, but here you are in a war zone and it's your home.
It was unbelievable. That's one of the things that was going through my head that day while I'm trying to take pictures. You know, when you're in a situation like that, you have to remember how to operate the camera, yeah. And there's all chaos around you, and you're just thinking, I can't believe this. Both towers are burning. People are covered with blood. They're streaming out. This is my city. This is New York. This is the United States. How could this be happening? It was really like a bad horror movie.
You've chronicled New York, the high points, then the low points. I mean, we're talking about the glory days of the 70s, but actually, politically and economically, it was a low point. We have had other low points too, but do you think if there's one good thing to have come out of 9/11, do you think it did, in a sense, change the community of New York for the better?
It brought New York City together to a large degree, and for a while, it brought New York City back into the United States. But, you know, there's a lot of very positive things that have come out of it. Of course, we're still hurting downtown. It's a total construction zone. You know what happened there, so there's a bit of sadness in that area, which you don't see in other parts of the city. But one thing that's happened that I'm working on, I've been working on a photo story called 9/11 Still Killing, and a lot of the first responders and recovery workers and downtown residents have been getting sick and dying from the toxic exposures to all the chemicals and pollutants that were released in the collapse of the building and the fires.
Yeah.
And so I've been photographing these individuals with their medications in the hospitals, going to funerals. And it's something that's going on, and a story that's getting bigger and bigger, and it's been ignored by the mainstream press. And I've met a lot of great people. I've become a part of this community. And, you know, before 9/11, I would go to fires and cover fires. Now I have friends who are firefighters, friends who are paramedics, and you know, we're trying to make something good come out of all this.
How is your own health? Have you been affected by being there in the thick of it?
Thank God I'm okay. You know, okay. Short term was, you know, I had the congestion and things, but thank God I'm all right now.
Now, there's been an exhibition in London of your work, and we've got to see your work, you know, in all its range coming north of the border. Is there any chance of that, of a touring exhibition of your work, Alan?
I would love for that to happen. I would love to have an exhibition in Scotland. I think that would be great.
Okay, we'll make it happen. Just before you go, tell me, of all the people you photographed, is there one outstanding person that you just loved capturing on film?
Well, I'd have to say it was John Lennon,
yeah.
Because I got to spend time with him. And of course, I love the Beatles. When I heard them in 1963 for the first time, I thought, this is amazing. I've been waiting for this. And was a fan of theirs, and John was my favorite Beatle. And I loved him as an individual, and, you know, after the Beatles as well. And the fact that he adopted New York as his home and really made himself into a New Yorker. And I really appreciated all the struggles that they did, all his outspokenness politically, and all his other creative talents besides music. And so to finally meet him and to photograph him and to become friendly with him was just something that is really one of the best things in my whole life.
And we could share that in the book, John and Yoko, A New York Love Story. I'll keep an eye on your post 9/11 project. Sounds absolutely fascinating, and I hope to see an exhibition here at some point in the future. But right now, Alan Tannenbaum, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Janice.
Oh,
John Lennon and Woman. You are listening to Janice Forsyth on BBC Radio Scotland, 92 to 95 FM, 810 medium wave, and online at bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland.